No, but when I talk about love, I'm talking about the most difficult, the most dangerous, the most subversive force in the world.
Yeah.
Because when you're talking about love, it means you have a steadfast commitment to the well-being of others, and you're willing to do what it takes to ensure that their humanity is always affirmed.
Yeah.
Always affirmed. That's what I mean by love supreme. When John Coltrane talking about love supreme, he's just not playing the saxophone.
Oh, yeah.
He's talking about his heart, his mind, his soul is a steadfast commitment to make sure that the well-being of all of humanity is elevated, and the best he can do is play his horn, just as the best we can do is occupy at the moment.
Yeah. All right. Good evening out there in podcast land. This is Charlie and Lorraine. Hello, Lorraine.
Hey, Charlie.
So we are doing a, we're continuing, and actually we're reaching what I'm going to call the climax of Act 1 of the Gospel of Luke. You know, if you think of it like a play, this has all been built up to this point, to what gets said here. Now, there's of course, there's sort of a turning point that's going to happen, but this passage takes some of the things that we've already said and puts a whole new level on some of them. So what we are doing tonight, we're going to start with Luke 5:33. We're going to read through the end of that passage, just kind of comment on what he's saying here, because it's an interesting take on religion, that we're gonna work on that, and then we'll move on to chapter 6, and particularly we're gonna focus our attention on 17 through, and I don't know why I'm telling everybody, you know, like mapping this out, but 17 to 26, because we want to get there. We want to spend the most time on those two passages, but then there are passages that come after that are important, and we will talk about those, all of this a little bit. So I want to, well, I've already said what I said, that this is sort of, to me, particularly that Luke 6 passage is one of the linchpins of my claims that Jesus is a proto-communist, that, you know, the reason we call this the People's Communist Bible Study is because of passages like the one we're about to read. And there are other passages on wealth that appear later in the gospel that will also sort of underscore the connection to wealth and elevation of the poor in the teachings of Jesus. So the last thing here, so in the very end of Matthew, Luke 5, Jesus has been sort of starting his ministry, a lot of it emphasis on healing the sick, visiting people. So in Luke 33, he's been talking to the Pharisees and scribes, teachers of the law, about, you know, they've been challenging him, why do you eat with tax collectors and sinners? And he says, it is not the healthy who need a doctor, but the sick. I have come to call, not come to call the righteous, but sinners to repentance. And if we look at, for comparison, how Cotton Patch translates this, and so we use the Cotton Patch version. If you haven't listened to before, I'll just briefly say Cotton Patch version of the Gospels are written by a fellow by the name of Clarence Jordan in Georgia in the probably 1960s. This was a multiracial commune dedicated to living a Christian life that included opposition to racism. And so Clarence Jordan translated the Gospels into the vernacular of Georgia. And so here's how he talks about this passage that I just read. The church members and officials said to Jesus' disciples or students, how come y'all eating and socializing with Yankees and N-words?
Ooh.
So, again, anti-racism is a fundamental motivation of this particular text, and so he sort of puts, he sort of, whenever he can drop in a racial reference to sort of elevate the bad guys, that is, so he's putting that in the words of the chief religious leaders of the time. They're putting Jesus down because he's eating and drinking with the wrong people. So Yankees and Negroes, black people. Another word is in there, and I'm not going to say it. I never say that word in any context, even privately. So it's one of those words I don't say. But it's the goal here is, of course, to emphasize that there was a sort of classism, elitism operating here in the questioning of Jesus. And then they said, now, so we're going to move to the next. This is down to. So, and then here's what Jesus says. He picked it up and told them, healthy people don't need a doctor, only the sick do. I haven't come to challenge the saved people to a new way of walking, only the sinners. Again, very Southern Baptist in the colloquialism there. So they said that John's disciples go to temple and say their prayers. So here's what it says. John's disciples often fast and pray, and so do the disciples of the Pharisees, but yours go on eating and drinking. So it's interesting that the Pharisees are there, but here he's not being questioned by Pharisees, or at least they're referring to them. I don't know. Don't want to make too much of that. That could be a translation issue. So disciples of the Pharisees, but yours go on eating and drinking. They question Jesus and his disciples about not being somber enough, doing too much partying, basically, which is kind of cool to know that Jesus was a party animal. And he answered, can you make the friends of the bridegroom fast while he is with them? The time will come when the bridegroom will be taken from them, and in those days he will fast. So this is sort of a veiled reference that Jesus is the bride, his followers are the bridegroom, the followers are the bride, there's this heavenly wedding, you know, it's sort of apocalyptic language. And then he says this, no one tears a piece out of a garment to patch an old one, otherwise they will tear the new garment, and the patch from the new will not match the old. No one pours new wine into an old wineskin, because the new wine will burst that skin, will run out, and the wineskins will be ruined. No new wine must be poured into new wineskins, and no one, after drinking old wine, wants the new. Wow. No one wants the new, for they say the old is better. Interesting. No one, after drinking old wine, wants the new. So it's interesting that... So he's saying the new wine is what we want, but he admits it tastes better to stick to the old for some people. Anyway. And
I think the reference in that section is that you've already been drinking. So you've kind of lost the ability to distinguish the good from the dregs that you've already had.
There you go. I like to say there's the story of the wedding feast in the Gospel of John, wedding feast at Cana, where Jesus turns water into wine. Everybody says, oh, this is wine is even better than the wine we got at first. Why did they give us the good wine last? You know, you're supposed to wait. Everybody's drunk. Then you give them the cheap stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it's a similar thing here. The emphasis here is that what's being said in the text and being set up in the text is this departure. Again, he's confronting the prejudices of the religious leadership of his time and saying that a new structure is coming into being, a new reality. And, you know, I'm calling the sinners not the saved. I'm calling the sick not the healthy. I'm undermining your assumptions and getting ready for a new reality. So this sort of continues in this vein. It tells a story about the disciples walking through a field of grain, picking heads off the grain on a Sabbath, and they're saying, oh, you're doing work on the Sabbath. Well, you know, haven't you heard that David, when he was hungry, got bread out of the temple and so on? And he said the Son of Man has authority over the Sabbath. Then he heals someone on the Sabbath. So there's a stretch of stories about the Sabbath. And the Sabbath, of course, is the sacred day of the Jewish faith. We think of Sunday as the sacred day, but in Judaism, sundown on Friday was the beginning of the Sabbath, and sundown on Saturday was the end of the Sabbath, and Sabbath is when they did synagogue, or if they had a temple practice, they would go to the temple, or, you know, and in Chicago area where I live, there's lots of temples and synagogues around, so you'll see people go into synagogue on Friday nights pretty regularly. And the Sabbath day is you can take it all the way back to the book of Genesis, where God creates the world in 6 days, and on the seventh he rested, and therefore the Sabbath becomes holy, a day of not working, a day of resting, which is actually a pretty kind of good economic principle, because we know that people want you, like you, to just to work yourself to death, right? The owners, the people who make money off of what you do, would like you to just work and work and work and never take a day off. So it's kind of nice that, at least in Judaism, they built in the idea of a day off right from the start. Now, so he healed the man on the Sabbath, got challenged for that. He says, well, you know, what is it right to do good and to bad on the Sabbath? Save life or destroy it. It's not inconsistent. And then he calls the 12. So this is chapter 6, verse 12. During those days, Jesus went up the mountain to pray, and all night long he continued to pray to God. At dawn, he called up his students, or disciples, and from them he selected 12, whom he designated ambassadors. The traditional translation says apostles. This is the first use of the word apostles in any of the Gospels. Well, it might be used in Matthew, but it's not used in Mark. Mark has a very dim view of the disciples, actually. He doesn't paint them as the future leaders of anything. So here, this word apostles, who is translated by Clarence Jordan as ambassador, he's saying that they're sort of the emissaries, is another word I think he's training them to become the emissaries of his kingdom. And he lists these names, and the interesting, you know, the names like the Zealot is in there. There's Judas Iscariot. It's sort of a cross section. There's others. I think in the early, in Luke, we talked about some of the meeting people and just calling them like out of the blue at some point, if I'm not mistaken. We did. Hello?
We talked a little bit about Levi and.
Okay.
There's a story about fishing boat. There's been a few here and there.
All right. Yeah, so I just realized I don't have... I'm using an app for my Bible tonight, and I don't happen to have the New Revised in this app. I will have to find an app that has it. So, because that's what I prefer to use of a more conventional, is the New Revised. This is the New International that I'm using. But this is... The 12 is an interesting number because 12 is, of course, the number of Israel, the tribes of Israel, right? So Jesus' 12 disciples are 12 replacements, if you will, for the tribes of Israel. So, and again, there's some debate among scholars about how, you know, whether this was a construction of the author of the gospel, the Lucan school, the people who put it together, or whether there really was this moment where Jesus picked out 12 disciples and said, you're mine, you're going to follow me. It doesn't have to even be nefarious in the sense of replacing Judaism. If it was just a call to renew Judaism, well, pick a person to help renew Judaism from that represents all the 12 tribes. So it's not necessarily anti-Jewish, although we know it gets used that way. So I'm about to jump into what I call the heart of this chapter here, Luke 6, what I've really been working up to. But before I do there, I want to ask Lorraine of anything you want to chime in, want to say, that kind of didn't get said about this, or to this point, or where we're going next.
No, I'm waiting for the sermon on the plane.
You're waiting for the sermon on the plane. All right, here we go. So, I'm going to read 17, and I'm going to actually look at the cotton patch version. So, it says 17, and Jesus came down with them and stood at the foot of the hill along with quite a number of his disciples or students, and a big crowd of people from all over. I'm going to read the Southernisms here. All over Georgia, around Atlanta, and even as far away as Virginia. They came to listen to him and to be healed of their diseases. So we talked about the healing. We talked about the significance of Jesus as a possibly a folk healer and as something that rabbis did. Rabbis cared for disease because they were considered the spokespersons for God, for the Torah. So they were the ones who were considered to get, they should have the knowledge of healing. So Jesus does this. Says, and those who were, and it says, literal, according, this is another Southernism, Clarence Jordan, those who were literally swarming with filthy spirits were cured. The whole crowd was trying to touch him because power flowed out of him and he healed them one and all. Everybody got healed. Quite a setting, right? Hundreds, thousands of people maybe. We know from the feeding of the 5,000, the 3,000, maybe this was only 1,000 or 2,000 because it was early days, right? But anyway, there's all these people coming. Many of them are sick, and Jesus is spending much of his time not teaching healing. I think it's very important. I think healing gets underrated in modern understandings of who Jesus is because, you know, we think of healing as something doctors do, not as something a minister does. But yet, as in the time of the Jewish culture, rabbis were the physicians. So and I think that's kind of important to understand that preaching, which is sort of the dominant religious activity among Protestants, almost takes a back seat, at least in terms of the energy and time that Jesus is investing. He's preaching, he does, but a lot of his time is spent actually just interacting with sick and needy people. He has his priorities. That said, he's about to give one heck of a sermon. And again, this is what we've been building to all along. So Jesus fastened his eyes on his students, his disciples, and said to them, "The poor are God's people because the God movement is yours. You who are now hungry are God's people because you will be filled. You who are now weeping are God's people because you will laugh. You are God's people when others hate you and shun you and pick on you and blacklist you because you bear the name of the Son of Man. Be happy at that time and jump for joy, for your spiritual pay is high. Why, their fathers did the very same thing to the men of God of their day. But it will be hell for you rich people because you've had your fling. It will be hell for you whose bellies are full now because you'll go hungry. It will be hell for you who are so gay now because you will sob and weep. And it will be hell for you when everybody speaks highly of you, for their fathers said the very same things about phony preachers, false prophets." So that's the cotton patch version of that. And people are a little more familiar with the phrasing, "Blessed are you who are poor, for yours is the kingdom of God. Blessed are you who are hungry, for you will be satisfied. Blessed are you who weep, for you will laugh. And woe to you who are rich, you've already received your comfort. Woe to you who are well fed, for you will go hungry. Woe to you who laugh, for you will mourn and weep." So what has stood out for me and why this passage has become, like, for me, the most critical passage in the Gospel of Luke. Some years ago, I don't remember who it was, some book I read on Christianity pointed out that whenever you hear somebody say, "Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth," they spend a lot of time instructing you on being meek and very little time on what it means to inherit the earth. Now, that's Matthew. Matthew's Beatitudes say, you know, "Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth." And what I consider here in Jesus is actually a prophecy. He is not just saying God's going to bless you in heaven after you die because you're poor or because you're poor in spirit, as Matthew says. He's actually saying there is a change in the world that is about to happen, that those who are on top are about to be brought down, and those who are at the bottom are about to be brought up. A leveling, if you will. And I would say this, you know, it's apocalyptic language, at least in the traditional way Christianity has been understood, but I would say, why isn't it revolutionary language? Why isn't it that in some level the poor rise up? It's not just that there's a miracle and the poor take power. You know, why not rise up? That said, so I'm not going to spend a lot of time arguing for that point of view, but I think you can see it. And so he emphasizes the poor, the hungry, and those who are weeping or grieving or mourning, and they're tied. I think he's talking about the same group of people. You are poor, you are hungry, and you're sad. I don't think it's, oh, the sad over here get one thing, the poor over here get another, and the hungry over here get another. I think he's saying, no, all of you have these four characteristics. You're poor, you're hungry, you're weeping and mourning, and people are hating you. You will be, this situation will be overturned. And so then, woe to the rich, woe to the well-fed, woe to those who are laughing because stuff is coming. You're going to lose what you have. So why I like this compared to, say, the Matthean version is that Matthew 5 doesn't have the woes. It has the blessings, but it then it elaborates them. It has, for example, blessed are the meek, not in Luke. And the scholarly hypothesis is that this passage and the one in Matthew are actually reflections of an older text, and a text that Matthew and Luke pretty faithfully draw from, which they call the Q source. Now, there's another way to interpret that. There's another competing school, and I don't want to get too much into critical, complicated questions. There are people who believe that Luke actually takes what he says from Matthew and Mark. Now, there are things in Luke that do not appear in either Matthew or Mark, but some people believe that when Luke cites a passage that sounds like Matthew, it really came from Matthew. And there are others who say, no, there's an independent text that's been lost to history, to the sands of the Middle East, that both of them were reading, but that they used in very different ways, because they do. The places where Matthew and Luke overlap are in different orders in the two Gospels. So either there was an original order that Matthew changed and Luke kept fairly close to, or the opposite. Luke changed the order and Matthew kept it fairly static. The only reason I want to go down there is because here is a case where this hypothesis called the Q hypothesis comes into play. Why do we have these two entirely, or not entirely, strongly different texts? Luke says, blessed are the poor. Matthew says, blessed are the poor in spirit. You know, blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness in Matthew. Luke says, just blessed are you who are hungry. Either Matthew added these little phrases, blessed are the poor in spirit, blessed are the hungry, those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, or Luke took them out. Any thoughts on that little question there?
Well, some of the reading that I've been doing in talking about the Q source or the Q gospel talked about Q as the oral tradition that had been circulating since the ministry of Jesus, and that's what both Luke and Matthew were drawing from, was this telling and retelling and this rote memorization of these stories and sermons and lessons. Specifically, what you were talking about in Luke saying, blessed are the poor,
right?
Period. Matthew saying, blessed are the poor in spirit. What we've talked about before in Luke versus Matthew is that Luke tends to be just more in this physical being with, you know, the needs of the body and the experiences of people in their day-to-day lives, and knowing hunger and knowing thirst, knowing rejection from their peers, versus Matthew, who gets a little more, I guess, esoteric, or, you know, not as grounded in physical experience, but the more spiritual dimension and the spiritual realm.
Yeah. And I, if I wanted to, like, again, I think that's a really interesting, I think that's true. It would be interesting to do like a line by line of when Matthew and Luke disagree about the body and the spirit, and Luke is emphasizing the body and Matthew's emphasizing the spirit, or the interior life, the morality, the subjective, if you will. Be interesting to chase that down and like try to thoroughly look at both texts and like, is that consistent? Is it really true? Because it's a good starting point. It's something to be interesting to work through. I'm sure I'd learn a lot. If, however, I want to play the advocate for the view that they're actually consistent with each other, one way to read this, so blessed are the poor in spirit, sounds like he's talking about people whose poverty is just simply a sort of renunciation of grasping on the wealth, you know, kind of Buddhist, oh, yes, I have these things, but I'm not attached to them. There's another way to read it, because the word spirit, pneuma in the Greek, meant something for them that it doesn't always mean for us. For us, we think of spirit and we think of an invisible floating silhouette or shadow of a living person, a ghost. The word Holy Ghost in the King James, for example, we tend to think of spirit as less substantial than a body. But that assumption, I think, can be questioned, and that spirit is very much a living, dynamic, powerful force. And I'll say I'm in a class right now at Meadville on the history of Christianity, and we just wrapping up our first week talking, and one of the things we've been talking about online is the day of Pentecost. So what happens on the day of Pentecost is they're in this upper room, they're praying, Jesus has gone back to heaven after his death and resurrection, and we'll cover this passage some detail somewhat later down the road, but the Holy Spirit falls and it looks like a rushing mighty wind and a flame of a tongue of fire lands on the heads of every person in the room and they start speaking in a tongue. It's a very embodied experience, yet it's the Holy Spirit, right? So you could say when Matthew says blessed are the poor in spirit, what he's saying is blessed are those who are infused spiritually with the passion of the poor. That's another way to read it. Now that's a stretch, but nevertheless, I don't want to spend a lot of time on saying Matthew is tinkering with the pure gospel of Jesus. I think there's ways to read these texts that complicate that simple opposition, but what's clear to me is that Luke is very clear. He doesn't give any qualifier to it, so he's talking about material poverty, and the fact that he contrasts it with the rich even makes it clearer. Matthew is doing something different in his text, and it'd be interesting to go through that one line by line and say, what's he really trying to say here? What's the climax of his exposition? Because he does end up in a similar place with denouncing false prophets. But anyway, so for me, the big carry away that I get from Luke is that there is a sort of what I call a class struggle. And that's a scary word in the United States because we're supposedly a classless society and we've accepted capitalism is the way. And so the fact that Jesus says the rich and the well-fed and the at ease, people who are taking life easy, enjoying, you know, taking pleasure in all of life, you're about to get your comeuppance, your overturning. Now, the fact that it didn't happen in his lifetime is an interesting thing. Was he saying this was something that's going to happen in his lifetime? Some people say he did, but nevertheless, it seems to me from this passage, it's fairly clear. And we also want to remember that this passage was probably written 40 years after Jesus was supposedly, after Jesus was crucified, 40 years. So it's a long gap. For some reason, this text hung around. Luke says that, you know, that there's going to be this overturning. The rich are going to lose what they have, and the poor are going to inherit the earth. Well, the meek inherit the earth, as Matthew says. And so this class, abolition, I call it this, the abolition of classes, is clear in the teachings of Jesus. And, of course, Karl Marx picks up the idea of abolishing classes, or creating the classless society, in his proposal for communism, which he didn't invent himself. He got it from other people, many of whom were Christians, who were advocating communism in the aftermath of the French revolutions. And he, of course, was trying to build on the German, create a German revolution and a British revolution against capitalism. So I think I have said a lot of what I wanted to say about this particular passage. It's, you know, it's kind of funny, like it's almost over. I've said what I've built up to for so many weeks, that there is a class struggle at the heart of the teachings of Jesus, that a consciousness of class struggle and a belief that the class struggle will be won by the power of the Almighty, the Creator, in favor of the poor. Sorry about that. Well, any comments, anything you want to add at this stage before we move into some later passages in this chapter?
I think in some ways this is the continuation of what we've seen in terms of, you know, who Jesus is choosing to associate himself with. You know, he's been questioned about all of these choices of, you know, will you spend your time with this group of people and this group of people? And what we see again and again are these are people who, by and large, have been either shunned by society, like the lepers, the unclean, those who are, you know, possessed of the unclean spirits, or they're people who have been forgotten about, you know, the poor, the hungry, to some extent, again, the sick. And so, again, Jesus is specifically calling out these groups, saying that, you know, society has put them aside, has forgotten about them, but no, I'm claiming this for them. I'm coming for them specifically.
Right. I totally agree with that. One of the interesting things that's occurred to me today is because I'm taking this class on Christianity, which I kind of knew I was going to take the class on Christianity, but I didn't realize that it would literally so closely dovetail with what I'm doing here in this podcast. Now, they're going to move on pretty rapidly into the history of Christianity after Jesus and his apostles. But what's interesting is things I was thinking about is the fact that the majority of the people that Jesus ministered to and the people who he claimed to be coming to save, to draw into this, what I would call a spiritual movement. Actually, I would call it a social movement. I would say Jesus wasn't founding a religion or a church. He was founding a social movement. And I don't know if I've said, I think I have said this in earlier, that religion wasn't really a category for the ancient world, that you had your social systems and your subcultures, Judaism, the Greeks, the Romans, the Zoroastrians, various cultures that had religious ideologies, but they weren't considered the separate thing we did on Sunday called church or religion. They were built into the cultures of their time, and whether you were a conformist or an establishment figure, you know, a conformist who went along with the social system or an establishment figure who sort of reinforced the system, your religion played into it. And if you were irreligious, you were in a certain sense rebelling against and questioning the order. And so Jesus is clearly questioning the order that's going on in Israel. In Jude, it's not Israel, but it's Judah and the Jewish territories, Galilee and so on. And the thinking that I had as I was listening to is that this sort of emphasis that we have on great people like Jesus. Let's take an example of him. He's one person. He lived 33 some years. He said these things. People wrote books about him, but he didn't write any of his own books. He spent his time, like we noticed at the beginning of this chapter 6, spending time with people who are sick, just, I mean, probably hours, you know, hundreds of people. I've been in a faith healing service where the minister prayed for literally nearly everybody there, and it takes time. It takes hours, and he did it. You know, I was one of the people who got prayed for. I was 9 years old. That's a story I may share another time. I won't. I wanted to be healed, and I went forward, and, you know, and so the image that this passage gives me in my mind is Jesus spends all this time healing people, and then he says, okay, all of you who have been participated in this today and you've gotten this healing, here's what's really up. We're going to overthrow this thing. We're going to bring about a global kingdom of peace and justice, and that empire that you hate and these religious leaders who are putting bondage on your bodies, we're going to turn that stuff over. The false prophets, they're going away. We're going to make a new world. Nothing less than a whole brand new world. You know, I sometimes say I'm not a Christian, but I am. Or I'm not. I don't know. I am a universalist follower of Jesus. I will own that. And what I was trying to say is that it's the masses. It's those people he's healing who don't make it into the books except as a crowd, right, as a faceless crowd of people who are sick. They make it in there, they get a mention, but they're really who this is for. It's not for the big heroes. You know, they're actually an obstacle to what the divine mission on earth is, which is to bring the world, bring around a new world, bring an order of love and peace and justice into being for maybe the first time since Eden, the Garden of Eden. I think I may have said it all. I'm done. Folks, I'm going to hang up right now. No, I'm kidding. I'm not. We have still have some time to go. And for a moment here, I'm going to go because we did talk about what we were going to do through the rest of this. You and I last week, as we ended, we talked a little bit about what we're going to do next week. So before we end today, I want to sort of go through some of that and just sort of talk about what's going to happen after this. But now I'm going to turn to another passage, and I'm going to give you the chance, Lorraine, to just read this passage in your favorite translation. And if you want, I'll read it in Cotton Patch as well. The next, let's see, we're starting with verse 27. And if you want, you can go as far as 39. No, well, 38, I should say, 27 to 38. And we can, you know, if you want to stop earlier, do it. Do you want to do that?
Sure. Okay. So I am working out of the St. Joseph edition of the New American Bible because, okay, again, my Catholic roots. This is the Bible that my mom gifted to me when I turned 16. And so this is what I keep at home. So we are, again, chapter 6, starting at verse 27. But to you who hear, I say, love your enemies. Do good to those who hate you. Bless those who curse you. Pray for those who mistreat you. To the person who strikes you on one cheek, offer the other one as well. And from the person who takes your cloak, do not withhold even your tunic. Give to everyone who asks of you, and from the one who takes what is yours, do not demand it back. Do to others as you would have them do to you. For if you love those who love you, what credit is that to you? Even sinners love those who love them. And if you do good to those who do good to you, what credit is that to you? Even sinners do the same. We'll stop there for now. There's a little bit more to that passage, but that's a good starting point.
All right.
So I think this is one of, along with, you know, the Sermon on the Plain and the Beatitudes, this is probably one of the better known portions of the Gospels, of, you know, turn the other cheek and all of the doctrine on loving your enemies. And what's interesting to me in this passage, so when I was growing up, the whole idea of turn the other cheek kind of got bandied around as this idea of just just take the abuse. Just, you know, mm-hmm. sit there. You made the comment earlier in the show about teaching people to be meek. And that's kind mm-hmm. of what it was, you know, if someone slapped you on one cheek, just stand there, be good, take it, and somehow that will benefit you, or, you know, you'll have, I don't know, grown as a person because you took that abuse. But
it builds character.
Right. It's a character building experience. But to put this in a little bit of historical context, talking about you know, being struck on the cheek, you would have been struck by the person's right hand, and for them to strike you on the their right hand to your right cheek, in order for them to strike you in that way, it's a backhand. It's humiliating. That's what a master does to their slave. And so, you know, you backhand somebody and they are lesser than you. Well, to turn the other cheek, in order for them to strike you again, they now have to strike you as an equal. So it was a little bit of a subversive act to suggest that, or kind of a reclaiming of your power to say, you know, if they strike you, turn the other cheek. Saying, no, I am not lesser than you. I am your equal, and demanding to be recognized as such and to be treated as such. Going on from that, you know, we get into the idea of if they take your cloak, don't withhold your tunic. Well, again, a little bit of historical context. People did not have wardrobes or closets full of clothing in that days unless they were very, very wealthy, which the people who Jesus is ministering to and preaching to are not those people. They would have had one or two articles of clothing, and so to give up both their cloak and their tunic, that may be all that they owned. So now you have a person who is naked. You made a joke before the show, Charlie, of, you know, take my clothes. Fine, take all of my clothes. Just have it. and what that drew to what brought to my mind is Saul Alinsky has a writing of Rules for Radicals, which Saul Alinsky was a community organizer, grassroots organizer who really focused on nonviolent protests and nonviolent resistance. And so in his Rules for Radicals, he has all kinds of strategies that have been employed in all kinds of different scenarios. But one of them specifically is to use ridicule, because ridicule is so hard to recover from, that if you can take your oppressor or take this person who is in power and just reduce them to nothing, they're not going to come back from that. They're going to be shamed, and they're just going to, you know, they're done with you. They would rather just give you what you want so that you'll stop embarrassing them. And that's what I'm thinking of, you know, Jesus' followers. You want my cloak? Sure, have it all. And now we just have a street full of people naked and running around going, yeah, sure, take it, whatever.
Yeah, so it's easy to read this passage as a sort of passage of counseling passivity, right? Let people walk mm-hmm. over you. That's what good, meek followers of Jesus do. But if you take into account the context, this is, again, Roman oppression, and who is the most likely to strike you would be a Roman centurion. In fact, although it's not in this passage, I'm looking down, it's not in here, but it is in, of all places, Matthew, that we've just spent some time sort of sideline, you know, giving some side eye to the way Matthew treats the similar passage in Luke. But what's interesting is that in Matthew's gospel, there's an additional, there's a third. If someone asks you to carry their load a mile, you carry it too. And what that does in there is it actually refers to a common practice of Roman centurions. So the Roman centurions, a company of 100 men that were armed and wearing armor and swords and were used to sort of police districts that were considered rebellious, like Judea and the Galilee. And so a Roman centurion by law could compel you to walk a mile with his pack on your back. And so by Matthew adding that, he makes it clear that who the aggressor in these three scenarios are. It's not just any old random neighbor who's pissed off at you. Sorry about my French. It's actually the man, right? It's actually the cops. He's saying, you know, if a cop comes up to you and smacks you across the cheek, say, oh, sorry, you want the other one too? You know, and if a cop says, hey, I need your cloak for something, you know, well, I don't know, to wipe grease off of my face. I don't know. I don't know why a Roman centurion would want a cloak. Maybe this isn't a totally applicable application, but, you know, he said, make yourself naked, right? It's certainly clear that most people wore an inner and outer garment, and that was it. No underwear, maybe a loincloth, maybe not, but, you know. The other example, so those are the two examples in here. Take your coat, give them your shirt, give to everyone who asks. Anyone who takes what belongs to you, do not demand it back. First of all, and I realize I left out a fairly obvious signal of what he's talking about here. Love your enemies. Do good to those who hate you. Bless those who curse you. Pray for those who mistreat you. He is not just... I still think by using the phrase enemy, he's not just talking about the neighborhood bully. He's talking about sort of the system, situation of oppression in Judea and in the Jewish territories. You've got the Romans, and they're just throwing their weight around. And, of course, you've got the high priests and so on who are collaborating with these people. So, oh, you know, you have to obey, and we passed this law. I think it was actually a Jewish law you can carry a soldier's pack for a mile. You don't have to carry it longer. And then, of course, Matthew has Jesus say, carry it 2 miles just to show them how good you are. Now, again, I don't want to pick on Matthew as being a bit too obsessed with moral purity, but in that maybe he was, because I sure wouldn't take it 2 miles. I'm sorry. My feet would never survive that. That said, of course, this was back then when people walked more. I think we agree that this passage is not just counseling sort of passive resistance, or not passive resistance, passive acceptance. It's not saying just accept the crap that comes your way. It's saying creatively retain your own dignity in the midst of a really difficult situation. How's that sound?
I'm with you.
You're with me.
On the walking 2 miles, I think it was a law of the Roman Empire. Like that was a law for the occupied people, that they could be conscripted into this mile of service. And I was reading a commentary that talked about the, you know, Matthew saying go with them to was actually, again, a subversive act, because they're now breaking their own law, because the law said they can only compel you to service for 1 mile.
Right.
And going with them too is kind of undermining that. And, you know, we made the comment before about just kind of showing the inhumanity of what's going on, or showing the oppression of what's going on. I noticed too, you know, we had just been making the comments about Matthew being more attuned to the spiritual life and Luke being more attuned to the physical life. And when I was flipping back and forth between the two passages, I actually just noticed this section actually does reverse that. Because when Luke is saying, you know, if you love those who love you, what credit is that? Even sinners do that. So that's the spiritual, moral life. Matthew makes the comment, for if you love those who love you, what recompense will you have? Do not the tax collectors do the same? And I think he also makes a comment about don't even pagans do the same thing.
Right.
Yeah. If you greet your brother only, what is unusual about it? Do not the pagans do the same?
And I'll tell you what I'm having here. I'm having a moment. So we talked the figure of the Roman centurion, which I kind of introduced here through by way of Matthew, comparing Matthew to Luke. What's interesting about Jesus' attitude towards the Roman Empire compared to, and remember way back early days, we talked about the four Jewish responses. There was the Sadducees, the Pharisees, the Essenes, and the Zealots. They all responded to Roman occupation in different ways. The Zealots said, let's overthrow it and create a national, new, renewed Israel, state of Israel. The Essenes said, no, withdraw and create a morally pure remnant of Israel. And the Pharisees said, well, just become moral here within the system and God will reward you. And maybe someday, if we're holy enough, God will take away the Romans. And the Sadducees says, well, let's just work with the Romans, see what we can do. Jesus' attitude is different than all of that. He has the zealot, boy, this is awful, we don't like it. But he doesn't have the, you know, he doesn't take up arms. He doesn't, I mean, I say he's most sympathetic to the zealots, but in the end, the zealots just wanted a national free Israel, a new Israel, free with their own king who was right, you know. It was a nationalist vision. Jesus, right here, says, love your neighbor, love your enemies. If you just love the others like you, what good is that? Because even, you know, the Gentiles do that. You should be more loving than the Gentiles. So this love ethic gets pushed in a direction of universalism, and what that can mean in the face of, say, a Pharisaical or a Sadducee understanding, or even the Essenes who, well, we're going to love the true Jews who are following the law as purely as we are, not the rest. And the Pharisees are doing their own version of that same song and dance. We're more moral than the rest of you Jews. The Sadducees, oh, well, we don't need to be all that pure. We just need to figure out how to survive and not get killed, which is a valid thing in its own right. But Jesus is saying, and so what I'm having here is that if you go all the way back to the temptation and Satan shows Jesus the king of the world, said you can have it, and Jesus says, I don't want it. I don't want those kingdoms. I'm here for a higher kingdom. The Roman Empire was sort of the known world, right? Obviously, they knew that there were those Mongolian hordes way over there that we can't get to, and in Africa. You know, they knew that there was something more than them, but in their mind, they were the civilized world. Jesus said, that's too small. I want the whole planet to come into an order, a reign of peace and justice. And so these tactical concepts of, you know, what you do when the enemy, the man, is harassing you. Okay, it's maybe a little too passive for me sometimes. You know, I'm leaning more and more as kind of this anarchist Marxist, let's take power. But I'm also aware that the guys on top, the ruling class, have all the power. And if you just go after them with armed conflict, you're going to get killed. And you're probably more of you going to get killed than them. So armed struggle, for me, is off the table on practical grounds, whether it's on the table as a moral question. But to me, so I kind of probably went on far too long with that. But I'm struck here by this passage and this universality of love that Jesus brings us to at the end. You know, love your enemies, because he wants you to go beyond. He says your righteousness, this is Matthew, I think, the righteousness must exceed the righteousness of Pharisees and Sadducees. You have to be, and that excessive love is universal. Love the Gentiles. Jesus is really saying in one level, love the Gentiles, which is something many Jews would have said you don't have to do because they're the unclean. And we haven't gotten into the teachings about the clean and the unclean except for the lepers, right? He talks about the lepers. And Jesus says, well, I don't consider them unclean. I heal them. I treat them. So we are about 6 minutes to go. And what we're going to have to do, I thought we were going to move forward a little faster than we did tonight. Because I knew I was going to spend a lot of time on the sort of heart of this. But then we got really some good talk there about the whole peace ethic and the question like that. So we could, because he says a lot of things. I mean, there's a lot of really good, the sayings of Jesus are pretty cool, even if we don't go through each and every one, because we just don't have time. What I had originally down is that we would move all the way to 9. We would skip 7 and 8 and go to chapter 9 and look at the feeding of the multitude, chapter 10, the rich young ruler, and chapter 11, the Lord's Prayer, and sort of treat those as a sort of thematic unity for next week. Is there any passage that we didn't get to tonight that you really want to touch on, Lorraine, next time?
My feelings won't be hurt if we don't, but I think it is, it does bear pointing out that, you know, some of the things that we're skipping over are a couple of other well-known passages. Still within mm-hmm. chapter 6 is the passage on judging others.
Yes.
And the passage on a tree is known by its fruit.
Mm-hmm.
I think those are some also big thematic concepts in Luke's gospel.
Right. I mean, they do carry this sort of loving, sympathy, empathy sort of teaching that he's doing throughout the whole passage. And then, of course, the tree and the wise and foolish builders has a whole somewhat different approach to it. I definitely want to get to the rich young ruler sooner rather than later. Because that's an important passage for my overall argument. And so I'm going to say we might visit this, but more as a jumping off into Luke 9, 10, 11 for our next. We're going to kind of cover sort of the feeding of the multitude, because that's an important story, but we're not going to spend a lot of time. And then the rich young ruler and then the Lord's Prayer. I really have another exposition of the Lord's Prayer, similar to what I do with what I did tonight with the blessings and woes. So let's, I think that's okay. That sounds, I mean, we can touch on some of this wrap up part in chapter 6, but then sort of transition quickly to catch up with where we were, where I wanted to be at the end. So we just did a little bit of planning on the air. Sorry for you listeners who are bored by that. Any final thoughts? Because we've got literally, I think, 3 minutes or less to wrap this up tonight.
I think I will save my thoughts for next time.
Great. Not great. Sorry to. We ran out of time. We really had a good time. We ran out of time. And we've got, believe me, if we did it every week, 2 hours a week, we'd still run out of time. So you and I are way too busy for that. So we do what we can.
Yeah.
All right. So thank you, everyone out there in podcast land. I think this was some exciting content tonight, both the talking about the passages on love and nonviolence, if you will, or non-resistance or resisting evil with nonviolence, however you want to put it. And then, of course, what we hear in the blessings and woes, which, as I said, are like, for me, a centerpiece. So we're going to move now into what I would call sort of act two. He's sort of set up what is going on, what he's trying to do, and now we're going to move into what happens with his movement and particularly the feeding of the multitude, the rich young ruler, which is a very important thing, a property, and then the Lord's Prayer. So join us next week, or not next week, 2 weeks from tonight.
2 weeks.
Same time, 8:30. Good night.
Good night,
Lorraine. Thank you. Thank you so much. I really appreciate you doing this with me.
Well,
bye, everybody.
Thanks for having me.